Next up is an interview with Travis Retke, who's the executive producer of BR Football. Now, several weeks ago, I went ahead and requested an interview with Travis to better understand the vision that Turner and Bleacher Report has for the Champions League, and to better understand their vision for the way that soccer has been presented to the viewers. Now, as you know, and as I know, the coverage is very different. The pre-match coverage, everything from the studio to the way it's presented, the format of it, the flow of it, is quite different. And I wanted to understand why. Why are they changing things? Why are they not going through kind of the traditional model? And I think this interview goes a long way to actually accomplish that, to understand from them firsthand what the changes are and why they're doing it this way. Now, Travis's responsibilities are in charge of content strategy and overseeing the production at BR Football. And here's that interview with Travis Retke from BR Football. All right, Travis, so let's start off in the beginning. Talk to us about your passion for soccer and your experience as a producer.
So first off, thanks a lot for having me on. My passion for soccer. So I'd say that I got into soccer originally in the late 90s following Arsenal. I think that a lot of Americans or Arsenal fans in general probably were very turned on by the team and the sport at that point. It coincided with the time where being in the U.S., you had opportunities to see a decent amount of Arsenal games as they were one of the most entertaining teams in the world. Have since, for the last 20 years, kind of been watching a lot of soccer any way that I can across the various platforms and channels that it's been available to U.S. soccer fans in the States. So I'm well aware of the different experiences that people have had with viewing the game and the different ways in which we've accessed the game over the last 20 years, but also aware of the fact that we do actually have a lot more soccer content for people to consume than a lot of other places in the world, which lends well to people who like to watch a lot of it. But it's also been distributed across a disparate amount of platforms and broadcasters over the last 20 years. So I've just spent a lot of my free time watching the game. I'm an Arsenal fan, but I've spent a lot of time watching a lot of Premier League teams, Bundesliga teams, La Liga. Basically, just watching as much soccer as I can over the last, particularly 10 plus years. And how did I get into my role at Bleacher Report? I started working at Bleacher Report about 10 years ago when it was a small company of about 12 people, and our main focus was on the NFL, college football, and really giving people the opportunity to learn about and write about and consume content on some of their favorite teams that they weren't necessarily covering or seeing enough coverage of. And I was doing business development for us at the time, actually our kind of in-house soccer evangelist, but it wasn't necessarily the right time or place for the company or the sport in the States to really focus on soccer as a content strategy for the company. So I worked for Bleacher Report for a couple of years, had left about 8 years ago now, and had constantly stayed in the ear of the BR team on if any opportunities had arose over the last few years, if there was any opportunity to get back involved with the BR team and any soccer coverage, that I would love to do so. So while I was gone, obviously the company grew significantly, was acquired by Turner, and had a lot of success, no thanks to anything that I did. And BR Football grew to being one of the biggest emerging brands in the soccer space. And about 2 years ago, Turner started having conversations about, or I guess it's a year and a half ago now, about acquiring the rights for the Champions League. And I started having conversations again with the content team here about putting together coverage plans for how we could potentially go about covering the Champions League and the Europa League in the States. Started off with casual conversations about things that we were observing and I was observing and the way that the sport was being presented, how we could cover it in a differentiated way, and how we could help grow the sport, especially amongst BR's audience. That went from casual conversations to more formal conversations and led to me getting the opportunity to work with the team here and help manage our content strategy around our Champions League and Europa League coverage, both across linear on TNT and across digital on BR Live, BR and BR football across our social channels.
And I think that's something too that definitely with you coming from the Bleacher Report, kind of the digital side of things versus say traditional, say I don't know, Fox Sports or going through kind of the TV side, the coverage is definitely different. And that's one of the reasons, the main reasons we wanted to have you on the podcast is to talk about that, to talk about TNT or Bleacher Report's vision for the Champions League and to better understand the vision for the way it's been presented. What are your thoughts about kind of just the way that soccer's been presented currently, just historically, and in what ways are you thinking about TNT and Bleacher Report having a different perspective on how it could or should be covered?
Yeah, so that actually, I mean, it definitely shapes the way that we look at our coverage and BR and our philosophy definitely influences the decisions that we've made from the programming and content side of things, but also, it was looking at it from the point of view of a fan as well. So traditionally, soccer, the way that it's been covered in the States, is it's a very linear-driven, appointment-based viewing concept. I think 10-plus years ago, we used to be able to not have to or not be able to watch Champions League during the day and DVR games and watch them at night. I used to do that quite a bit with friends, having friends over to do that. We could get away with being able to not see the scores and kind of suspend the reality until 8 hours later when you watch the game. But for the most part, if you are a soccer fan and you're in the States, I'm out based on the West Coast, you have to watch the games at a time that isn't the most convenient for a sports fan. So especially with the Champions League, you're watching it in the middle of the day, whether you're at school or at work on a second screen, whether you're ignoring work or ignoring school or you're going out to the bar to watch the game with fellow fans for a couple hours. And on weekends, you're watching it early in the mornings or mid-morning before your day starts. But that doesn't necessarily lend well to growing the game amongst the casual audience or even getting people who are somewhat interested in the sport more interested in the sport. And traditionally, there hasn't been a lot of distribution of what we call shoulder programming, which is the content to get people excited about games, the content to analyze what happens in the games, the content to tell stories about players and teams and clubs that isn't programmed beyond just the TV show. So if you wanted to learn more about the game, you either had to identify certain personalities or certain publications or broadcasters to follow, or you'd have to be proactive in identifying times or like making time in the middle of your day or morning to watch a game. So what we're really looking to do, combining the presence and the reach that we have with TNT with the same that we have with Bleacher Report and BR Football, is really deliver 24/7 coverage of soccer, the teams, the players that you care about, and tell stories about those teams, players, and clubs, while also giving you everything you want to see from highlights and the analytical side of things and covering the teams and players that you care about. So the way that we think about our studio show is, because the studio show is running on at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, we realize that some people are going to sit down and watch that, but there is a way for us to reach a significantly larger audience and a more casual fan base by creating content segments and highlighting certain aspects of the game that work just as well for a soccer fan or a sports fan to connect with and watch that content on our social platforms, whether it's on Facebook, whether it's on Instagram, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's on Snapchat, whether it's on BR Live, where we're streaming the games. We think about a strategy of the content that we're creating and think about where we can best program that across all of our platforms or how we can do that.
Now, watching the BR Football coverage, I mean, really everything is different when you think about it. BR Football, you have an hour or close to an hour as opposed to, say, 45 minutes with Fox last season with the old schedule where we had games at 2:45 Eastern. The studio.
Yeah, I think we benefited greatly from that 10-minute time change. It helped us out a lot in terms of being able to put some stuff in there.
Yeah.
And also the two-game window, I think, is great for a fan experience as well.
Definitely. So the timing is different in terms of having more time to do some pre-match analysis. The studio is completely different. The design of the set, even down to the clothes the people are wearing, even down to the personalities. Yep. Just even the way the flow of the programming is different too. And I definitely applaud TNT and Bleacher Report for trying different things. What's your thoughts so far on how well it's been done, and is there an opportunity to raise the bar and make even more kind of fine tuning to make it even better?
Yeah. So to answer that, I think that the way that we present the show and the way that we want our talent to dress, or the way that we want to put forward the way that we talk about the sport, is, for me, it's all about comfort and making the talent comfortable, making sure that the conversation on the set flows well, and making sure that people are talking about what they want to talk about. For me, what's most appealing and interesting to listening to people who know what they're talking about, talk about soccer, is authenticity. Like, we don't want to force talking points upon people. We don't want to force opinions upon people. We just want to give our talent the opportunity to talk about the game that they love, and do so in a way that is insightful. And that's interesting to fans and casual fans of the sport, who are interested in what they have to say. I think with the presentation of the studio, like you said, it's different. For me, we want the studio to be understated, to put the emphasis on and the interest in the people who are there talking about the sport, because they're the ones who matter. Obviously, it's important for us to show you, the highlights and the images of the game that are important to people, but it's also interesting. It's also important to give those guys the opportunity to be the stars of the show who bring you their opinions. I think in terms of the content of the show that we've created, I think we're doing a great job right now of creating content that appeals to people who might not necessarily be diehard fans, who are interested in the sport and want to learn more. I think I'm really proud of and excited about some of the storytelling that we're doing, some of the stuff that we're doing with Fernando on site and really delivering what it's like to be on location and tell you about the culture of some of these cities and these fan bases, and kind of transport our audience to the most of us won't have the chance to actually go out and see a game in Europe, to give them the opportunity to see kind of how crazy some of these stadiums are, how awesome that experience is, and how passionate some of these fan bases are. I think in terms of something that I'm very sensitive to, given the amount of soccer that I watch and the amount that I care about good analysis, and something that you guys are definitely sensitive to as well, is I think that we can get better in terms of prepping our team and getting the guys in a better place to be able to have some more in-depth analysis on some of the games, both in pregame and postgame. I think that that's something that comes with getting people more comfortable with one another. That's both both on camera and our team just getting more reps and more comfortable. But I think it's also just creating good topics for people and good analysis capes or situations for guys to have more in-depth conversation about stuff that people like us as soccer fans want to hear. I think that it's gotten better, and it's something that we're constantly working on, but it's definitely something that I see us needing to continue to get better week to week.
Now, with everything being so different, the set, the talent, you name it, across the board, was that something that was done because that was based on research, or was kind of the thinking within BR, Bleacher Report, or was that kind of a top-down kind of directive, okay, we need to do things differently, or is it change for change's sake, or was there a kind of a blueprint that went along with, because it is vastly different for the viewers that are tuning into these games?
It's actually, there's a lot of inputs. It's inputs from internal input from conversation that we've had with fans, how we see what kind of content performs well on our social channels, and then just talking with the team at Turner, who, in my opinion, puts out the best sports show out there with Inside the NBA, and talking to the production team there and seeing the philosophy around how they put shows together and how they manage talent, and obviously the guys that they have on that show have been working together for a long, long time and are the best at what they do. So it's not like, saying that we're going to do Inside the NBA for soccer, but there's definitely a lot of things that we learned from them. And our approach and the way that we're going about doing this coverage, I view our coverage, and not to make a business analogy with it, but what we're doing is, it's basically a startup. So we have ideas, we have vision, we have a vision for what we want to do, but it's very much in the BR and BR football way of creating ideas and content that we think that will work, seeing how people react to it, see how it works out in play and practice, and make adjustments to make sure that we're creating the best content experience for the audience that we want to reach, which is, in this case, we want to create something that soccer fans are excited about and feel like they're getting the depth that they want and need from coverage, but also creating something that makes the sport more approachable and interesting to an audience who wouldn't necessarily have spent 2 hours, or in this case, 6 hours, watching soccer on a Tuesday or Wednesday afternoon.
Now, the other big change, too, is the two studios. And in regards to the LA studio, was that done out of convenience for Stu Holden and Steve Nash, or was that part of a strategy thinking in terms of just having something different?
So to me and to us at the BR team and Turner team, we see LA as the cultural epicenter for the sport in America. I think if you look at footballers' Instagram accounts and social media accounts over the course of the summer, they're all going to LA when in their off season. I think that when Lukaku signed with, or when Pogba signed with United, they were on a rooftop in Hollywood or Beverly Hills a couple of years ago, you know, high-fiving each other and being really excited about them playing with one another. Like, you constantly see images of guys in LA in the off season. To me, it's got the cachet, and it's got just that standing amongst European footballers that's the place that everybody wants to be. We also, I think you guys saw last week, we brought in Dominican Sue on as a guest. We do see having guests as being a key component of our coverage, and not just guests who play FIFA or who have a kit collection, who like the sport, but people who are evangelists of the game and really excited to come on and talk about why they love the game. And to us, LA is no better place in America to be able to get guests and to have people who are influencers and interested in spreading their love of the sport. There's no better place in America than Los Angeles to have them there.
Which in some ways is actually pretty controversial, though, too, because I think a lot of people look at the U.S. and may not think of L.A. as kind of being the epicenter of soccer.
Yeah. I mean,
you can look at Miami as a place, too, terms of, you mean, there's no team there right now, but or some other cities, or New York. But I believe you're from California. I think you're producing the show from California. Was that part of the equation, too?
No, we're producing the show from Atlanta. And I'm out in Atlanta one day a week. I'm out in LA one day a week for match weeks. To be honest, it had nothing to do with that. There's a few different factors as to why we did LA versus Atlanta. My Delta travel status is not one of them. It's just something we did because Atlanta is obviously our home base for where Turner is based, where we've got all of our production facilities. We've got the studio there, but just felt that for getting guests and for getting the people that we wanted involved, Los Angeles made a lot of sense.
Okay. And just a few follow-up questions, too. This is from some of our listeners. The first is,
yep.
Why no pre-match or post-match interviews with the managers?
So that was something we've talked about. It's something that we're not saying absolutely no to. For us, it's a matter of just, we're watching those on the world feeds while we're running our show. And if we find the right content, we will put that on the post-match show or pre-match show. But for us, it's more important to, especially in pregame, to set the stage for the game, via analysis and storytelling and using what we see as the best content available, to drive good, insightful conversation around the games. But for post-game, we haven't yet seen an opportunity where it made sense to drop it in. I wouldn't say it's something that we're not going to do in the future.
Okay. Yeah, and you got the Juventus Man United game coming up soon, so depending on Mourinho's state of mind, it could be an interesting time to do
believe me, I find Klopp and Mourinho post-game interviews can be incredibly entertaining, and they do lend to really good sound bites that drive good conversation around things. But for us, it's an editorial call on the fly, and if it works well, we'll drop it in. If it doesn't, we'll go with more conversation and analysis around the games.
So the next question is, and this is one from many, many people, but why can't we have some of the games maybe on TBS or True TV? I mean, we're at a point to, I think, especially this season, more than any others really in the Champions League, there's been so many high-profile teams playing at the same time in big, big matches, whether it's PSG or with Real Madrid, Liverpool, Man United, Bayern Munich. We're actually spoiled for choice. But TNT is the only TV channel that's actually broadcasting. Any opportunity in the future to have, if there is a kind of an overlap, and have another game on TBS or True TV?
So the plan right now is for TNT. I do think that I completely understand where people are coming from on that. I do think that would be our live, the opportunity that we have right now in terms of offering people to watch one-off games or subscribe to the package at a discount to what previous broadcasters had offered in the past, I think is a compelling offering. But again, I understand where people come from. I do also think that the window, the two-match window that we have in each day, enables soccer fans to now be able to watch six straight hours of soccer coverage if they want to do that, which I think is something that I'm really excited about that hasn't been available in the past. But right now the plan is to program the games on TNT.
Okay. And then the last question I have is in regards to the talent. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about kind of the why the talent was picked. They definitely seem to be more personal, seem to be more a little bit different than what we're used to in the past in terms of chemistry and banter and how they work together. Which came first? I mean, was it that you were looking for people with those personalities, or was it that it just came naturally?
So the people that we went after and for our talent are people that we've been watching and have been fans of for a long time. I've said this to a few people, and I firmly believe it. I think Kate Abdo is the best host that's available in sports right now. I think she's also a perfect blend for us in terms of somebody who's got a lot of traditional broadcast experience, but it's somebody who is comfortable working in a non-traditional broadcast in the way that we're doing the coverage. I think she's handled it incredibly well and very excited to work with her. So she was somebody that we had identified from the beginning that we wanted to work with. Stu, I see as the voice of U.S. soccer right now. And he is, and obviously has had a big rise in soccer broadcasting and was broadcasting the World Cup final for Fox last year. But also a guy with an incredible personality. And in the instances where we saw him in studio, thought it would be great to give him an opportunity to be a studio analyst for us. And also excited to give him the opportunity to take on more of a role as kind of a second host in Los Angeles. And when we chatted about it, we saw eye to eye on, you know, the way that we were going to cover the game and the way that he wanted to, what he wanted to do and the way that he wanted to cover it. And it worked really well. I think with Tim, obviously one of the greatest players in U.S. men's national team history, but also had, I really liked the experiences that I saw him broadcasting when he was on off weeks, when he was with Everton, and some of the work that he had done in the past. And another guy that we had dinner with Tim, and it was like, this is somebody that is perfect for us. And I know that you guys have mentioned that you've enjoyed Tim when he's on set, Karthik in particular, and excited Tim starting this next match week is going to now be on the show 2 days a week in the off season, because now we have a little bit of time with him not doing his day job for him to be able to with us to work with us for a couple of days a week. So we're really excited about that. So we'll have him on board for the rest of the group stage. With Mo, I feel like Mo is like when I was watching Stu on ESPN FC a few years ago when he was dealing with injuries and was spending some time trying to figure out what he was going to do. And when I saw Mo and then talked with Mo about him really getting the intersection of sport and culture and the kind of stuff that he wanted to talk about while still having a great experience in the game and a bright future ahead of him in broadcasting, I thought it would be a great opportunity for us to work with him early on and especially help us grow the game. I think that Mo is perfect for that. Really excited about the first few shows that he's done with us and the conversations that we've had about other opportunities on things that we can work with him. I think he's going to be great for us. And with Steve, like for me, we really wanted to have a different angle of covering the sport through the eyes of somebody who wasn't just your traditional soccer analyst. And Steve's been one of the biggest proponents of the game in America ever since I've heard him talking about soccer. He also, if you sit down and talk with him, he knows the game better than the vast majority of analysts that I've seen on TV. So when we sat down and talked with Steve about the way we wanted to cover it and how we saw the opportunity with him to really bring in a new fan base that wouldn't necessarily have watched a pregame show or watched soccer coverage, and chatted with him about that and just talked to him about how he wants to grow the game in the States, especially amongst a younger demographic, and kids, and help grow the development of soccer in America, that worked out really, really well. And I think Steve's been doing a great job a couple months in for us. Really excited about some more stuff that we can do with him and Stu, especially out from behind the desk. We shot a really fun segment with them after one of their pickup soccer games yesterday that we're really excited to show in the game or in the coverage next week. But that's kind of the philosophy behind who we had. I also think that this of any group of analysts that I've seen on TV, like Stu and Steve, obviously are very good friends on and off the screen. But you can immediately see their chemistry and how well they get along with one another. I think that everybody else, like the Atlanta studio, now that we've got a cohesive unit there, we've definitely seen improvements week over week with those guys' comfort level with one another. And just really excited about getting more shows with them all together and the conversation that can come out of it.
Yeah, most definitely. And actually, you just raised one point that I wanted to just to follow up on. Talking about the intersection between culture and soccer, or culture and sports, do you think, in a way, though, too, that there's two separate audiences? There's maybe one audience that's more social media driven. Maybe it's more the kind of into the culture as far as what the athletes are wearing, versus, say, maybe it's an older or more traditional audience that's there just to watch the games. And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this is something that I'm very sensitive to, and that I mentioned a little bit earlier, but something that I'm constantly thinking about in the way that we do our show. And the way that we've, create our plan around what we're going to cover each week is we do it with two audiences in mind, right? And that's the audience of people who are tuning into the game to watch the game, either the team or player that they're fascinated with and really excited about, or just to watch it because they love the sport. And what we need to do is we need to make sure that those people are getting what they need. We need to make sure that they're getting the analysis that they need, the news that they need, the coverage that satisfies them as a soccer fan. And for me, you can do that while also creating content that is interesting to an audience beyond them. So I think that even a diehard soccer fan is going to be interested in learning about Neymar's tattoos and his life story through those tattoos. Or a casual soccer fan is going to be interested in something like the Pep piece that we did, that I think is one of the most candid interviews I've seen Pep do, about a month ago, because of the way that it was visually presented and he told interesting stories about what his philosophy was. So there is content that we can create that can cater to both audiences. But I also feel like if we set up our talent to have conversations where they're talking about things that they're passionate about, and going in depth and talking about a particular play or player or tactics or formations, I think anybody's going to be engaged by somebody who knows what they're talking about doing so in a passionate way. Mm-hmm. So I also think that with something like we're doing with the Champions, which I know that might not necessarily work with all demographics, I think that it is one of the best performing things that we have right now on our social channels. And it's doing really well, and we're getting very positive responses from diehard fans and casual fans alike. But I think that if we create content and a show that appeals to a broad audience and we go deep enough that our soccer fans who are more traditional or, excited about our coverage or like the way the things that we're saying or the way that we're covering things, that they will then be a little bit more open to some of the other content that we're programming. Or at least that's my hope. And that's what I would think, is if our audience is happy with what we're doing, they will give us more leeway or more of an open mind to test out new content, or, you know, give us a little bit of an opportunity to try new things for them.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned before too about being a startup, kind of a startup philosophy. In a way, do you see you guys as being trendsetters in terms of the way you're integrating social media with traditional television?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call us trendsetters, but I'd say that we're definitely doing something that's differentiated from anything that's been done before. I think that, and the reason we're doing it is because we don't think that the way that it's been done traditionally lends to growing the game to the extent that we want to. I think that, you know, soccer is the biggest participation sport in America for kids, right? It's the second biggest sport for a young demographic. I think it's for the, you know, teens and early 20s. But at the same time, the sport's not being presented to them in a way that's best for them to consume it. I think that, you know, kids can't watch TV in the middle of the day at school, but they can check their Instagram feeds. They can check their Facebook feeds. They can check Twitter and see and engage content that way. So it's important for us to deliver the sport to people who are interested in it on whatever platforms we can.
And one last question, I promise. And that's about, coming from a Bleacher Report background and knowing Bleacher Report as I do in terms of all the metrics, all the data points, all of the analytics, looking at all these different data points from social media, from the web. Do you feel in some ways that with television, the metrics that you get aren't as detailed as you would like? And it's maybe sometimes harder to make some actionable decisions based on limited data versus BR Live, which is BR as a company, which is very data driven.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, having a online platform makes it easier for you to make data driven decisions. But what I think helps us is the fact that we're creating content that can live in both places. So we can look and get a good feel for how the content works well within a TV show setting, but then we can also see how it performs on some of our channels. And I know that the demographics are going to be a little different for a TV show than they are for our BR football audience or even our BR audience, because, you know, our BR football audience is soccer fans. Our BR audience is sports and sports culture fans. So that's not going to give you a true read, but it's relying upon how things perform within the show, how they feel to us as the creators of the show and fans who know the sport, and then how it performs on social, and kind of combining all of that to then drive our content decision.
Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news.
Yeah, so New Fox, as it's now being branded, or at least branded by the media, is prepared to buy back the U.S. regional networks like Fox Sports L.A., Fox Sports Florida, et cetera, Fox Sports Ohio, that are part of the transaction with Disney and ESPN. They're prepared to buy those back from Disney and ESPN. It appears like they will be the high bidder. Very, very confusing, but just real clarification, because I actually helped with the sport business story on this in terms of research, et cetera. Fox, the new Fox under Rupert Murdoch's son, wants to focus exclusively really on news and sports, and they're dumping entertainment, right? They're dumping that sort of stuff and additional stuff. The regional sports networks, if they can be bought back for less than $20 million in value, I think enhance what the new Fox is trying to do. So it looks like also maybe to get some regulatory approval, this might happen. So watch this space. That covers a lot of MLS teams in terms of soccer and MLS teams local deals, which are essentially split between the Fox regional networks and the Comcast / NBC. Now they're all branded NBC, but NBC regional networks.
Okay, Kartik, moving on in regards to some more news, and this is Major League Soccer. So the headline story is coming out of Sports Business Daily, and it reads, U.S. broadcast viewership for Major League Soccer up 6% this season as MLS matches on Fox proper and ESPN Deportes see their strongest viewership yet. Univision also had its most watched Major League Soccer season also. So yes, while that's true, that's great news. MLS viewership on the Fox Network, which televised five games, was up 59% year over year, averaging 988,000 viewers. And Univision saw a 14% growth in total numbers, averaging 287,000 viewers, marking its most watched season to date. So while that's good news, we know that the trend is that on the Spanish language side, in terms of viewing numbers, whether it's for Premier League or if it's for Major League Soccer, etc., those numbers continue to increase. And the Spanish language side is really kind of a growing side of the industry, side of the sports TV ratings. What this headline really kind of masks, though, is that the MLS viewership on Fox, the big Fox, the over-the-air network Fox, really inflates the numbers artificially, because what the story doesn't tell you is that the viewing numbers on FS1 for Major League Soccer are down, as well as on ESPN, they're down compared to last year. And the only reason that the numbers actually overall are up 6% is because the over-the-air Fox numbers were artificially stimulated or artificially inflated by having those Major League Soccer games on immediately after World Cup matches, where soccer fans might be partying, might be having the TV left on, not even watching the game perhaps. So some of them may be watching the game, but really kind of trying to take advantage of that situation, which there's no problem with that. I think it's a good strategy. My kind of concern with it is that short-term, it helps the numbers. Long-term, it's not helping them, because if you look at the World Cup numbers and what that Major League Soccer got, and over a million viewers for some of the games, you would expect a lot of those fans now to be hooked on Major League Soccer and that the FS1 numbers would be up. Well, the FS1 numbers are down, so there's an issue there. So people are tuning in, watching the World Cup, and then watching Major League Soccer games, inflating the numbers. And that's a great thing to put in a press release that Major League Soccer can announce, or they can put in a Sports Business Journal article that makes everything look bright and rosy. But at the end of the day, the reality is that you take those World Cup numbers away from those Fox broadcasts that were the Major League Soccer games, and the TV viewing numbers are a completely different story. Kartik, any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, a year from now, when MLS network ratings, ratings on Fox over the air and Univision are down or stagnant, then that's when the lack of long-term thinking with bolstering this will come out. I think it was more a propaganda piece than anything else to say, well, these numbers are up. Remember, they did the same thing when they attached a match to a Copa America match in 2016. It was Seattle and Portland, or Seattle and Los Angeles. And I was actually alarmed that the number was so low, given it came after Copa America and it had the teams that were playing. But they, at the time, MLS PR put out, oh, this is a 30% bump or whatever from last year, from fixture date last, the previous season. So they're good at doing this. I think in general, there's been a problem in drawing viewership for MLS games on FS1. We consistently see ESPN games do better, even if they're scheduled alongside MLS, alongside NFL matches, NFL games. So it might be an FS1 problem, and that's something that is going to have to be figured out by 2022 when the new contract is up for renewal for Soccer United Marketing.
Yeah, the headlines for me from this story, I'm worried about our ESPN and FS1 numbers going down, and especially FS1 numbers, which are lower than ESPN numbers. So there's an issue with the English language side as far as numbers not increasing. And part of it is the calendar. I mean, part of it is just the scheduling. But still, there's enough games played throughout the entire year to boost those numbers, even when this time of the year is kind of crazy in terms of all the college football and NFL football happening.
And MLS is really they're in a catch-22 in a way, because I have to say, no league on the planet — then again, there are a lot of other sports I don't watch, so maybe I should say that — no football league on the planet is as accessible in terms of its ability to cut highlights quickly, and if a goal happens, you see it 5 minutes later on the internet. From an official channel, not from an illegal stream or streamable or one of those things, than Major League Soccer. I mean, if you are not watching the match on ESPN and FS1, and you're on your on Twitter or you're on the internet, you see the goal 5 minutes later. So, yeah. And I realize they have to do that to maintain interest. At the same time, it's a disincentive sometimes for me to watch the game live because I say, okay, if Portland scores a goal, I'm going to see it soon enough anyway.
Yeah. Social media-wise.
That's a credit to MLS Digital. They're great at that.
Yeah, MLS Digital is killing it as far as the social media.
Absolutely.
I mean, that whole game, I mean, they own that space and they do a fantastic job. My concern is about national TV ratings and those numbers decreasing except for games that are played right after a World Cup. And so we'll have to wait and see next year to see what those numbers are like. I mean, they will have the Women's World Cup and the Gold Cup, but it's going to be more challenging to schedule those games. The U.S. women's games will definitely draw huge numbers.
I tell you, it's going to be really difficult also, Chris, because the tournaments are going on at the same time. They might have Women's World Cup matches bumping up right against Gold Cup matches. So they may not, unless they try to do a triple header or quadruple header or something. So it's more challenging, the scheduling, than this past summer.
True. All right, Kartik, so we've got some news next about La Liga, which will be of interest to listeners in the U.S. in terms of what's going on and the chances of this Barcelona-Girona match happening or not.
Yeah, so Gianni Infantino, I think a lot of people probably caught this already, has opposed La Liga plans formally, saying that following a request of guidance from the Spanish FA, U.S. Soccer, and CONCACAF, which are the governing bodies concerned with this. The council emphasized the sporting principle that the official league matches must be played within the territory of the respective member association. FIFA statutes suggest that they are able to block La Liga's plans. Article 71 says the governing body may take the final decision on the authorization of any international match or competition. Now, Javier Tebas and La Liga dispute this. I was in the room. Tebas is going to be back in South Florida in a few weeks for SoccerX, so we'll see what he has to say then, although La Liga's taken action more immediately, as you're alluding to, Chris. Tebas claims that FIFA has no jurisdiction over this. Infantino saying under Article 71 they do. So we've got a standoff, and now La Liga, Chris, as I think you're alluding to, has launched a media campaign as of this week to try and get American fans engaged with the idea of La Liga match on American soil. So this thing is continuing to play out. This has become very, very dramatic. I think, again, as I think perhaps I said it last week or the previous week, sometime recently on the podcast I mentioned, my belief is that this is not about Girona and Barcelona. This is about future matches. This is about moving Champions League matches to Miami or New York. This is about the possibility of the Premier League playing matches in China or Australia. This is about closing the Champions League potentially, making it or closing a European Super League. All of those potential principles that could use this one match as precedent. I think it has to do with that. It has nothing to do with Girona and Barcelona playing in Miami. And I don't think anyone at the FIFA level really cares about that. They care about if we allow this precedent set. It's just like U.S. law, right?
Yep.
If you set a precedent in some sort of legal matter, what are the consequences down the road? I think that's what's going on here.
I agree, but I think it's bigger than that. I think it's all about the NFL. And I think with NFL getting into London soon to have, you mean, a lot more games played there, but also probably soon to have a team in London, that this is really more about global sports viewing. And La Liga making a very, very aggressive push in the United States to start bringing games here and competing against the NFL and just trying to make sure that they have that global audience. And yes, it has a big impact on the Premier League with their efforts to try to get games played in the US, although that looks unlikely. It's all about the world sports and the world's TV viewing audience. Now, the campaign that you mentioned, Kartik, was actually launched this morning. So it's called Bring Us the Game or Bring US the Game. And let me just read a little bit from the email that came through this morning from Relevant Sports. And it says, we have some big news. La Liga, the greatest soccer league in the world, which is debatable depending on how you can rate that, is trying to bring a regular season match to America for the first time ever. But we need your help to make this happen. Sign the petition. So that's what they're going for, is to try to get people to sign the petition so they can say, hey, we have, you know, 500,000 people have said that they want a game in the United States between Barcelona and Girona. you're preventing them from being able to watch this soccer game. And probably looking at FIFA, looking at USSF at this, or Major League Soccer, saying, hey, we have people that want to watch this game here. The email goes on, it says, there's only one problem. Some of the key decision makers are determined to block the match from happening, falsely claiming it's not good for the game in the US. So we, the fans, the true stewards of the game, need to fight for this match. Are you in? The more people who sign this petition, the louder a voice we will have and the harder we'll be to ignore. Help us make this happen for the fans and the game. Together we can. Hashtag bring US the game. And stay tuned, La Liga North America. So really aggressive push here from La Liga and from Relevant Sports to make this happen, to get the petition signed, and to really, really push this in the faces of FIFA, of CONCACAF, of US Soccer, and of Major League Soccer to say this needs to happen. Whether it'll happen or not, we'll have to wait and see. I'm not going to predict this one, but it is very, very interesting.
Let me just mention the politics real quickly of this and Infantino's position. Infantino, even though he was the president of UEFA, has essentially lost a lot of support within UEFA in the last 3.5 years. The Club World Cup proposal being the final straw for a lot of UEFA member federations, the more prominent federations, the Germany, the Spain, the England, the Netherlands, just more FIFA, more international dates. And we saw how that went last week. We talked about that on the podcast last week. Infantino's going to get reelected probably because of the support of Asia, because of the support of Africa, because of potentially the support of CONCACAF. So, and certainly the support he has from the U.S., who are big supporters of him. So his political play is to do what these federations want, which is a fear of La Liga or the Premier League and Serie A, whoever, but La Liga now putting matches in their countries and undercutting, or in theory, undercutting their domestic league. So that is the political play for Infantino. He's not going to back off on this. Now, whether he actually has the authority to do this, which has been questioned, we'll see. Or whether there's just a groundswell of support to where they have to back that down the campaign, we'll see. But there's a lot of politics involved in it. FIFA presidential re-election for Infantino, which comes next year, by the way, 2019.
Yeah, I can see this one actually. If I had to make a prediction, I can see this going into the courts because, FIFA believes that according to the FIFA statutes that they will be able to block this game. That Article 71 says that the governing body may take the final decision on the authorization of any international match or competition. La Liga probably has some claims on their part that they can say, hey, well, there's been precedent set before with games being played overseas, whether it's cup games such as the Supercopa, España, or some other games being played overseas. So there's been precedent set, and why can't this game be played in Miami? This is really, really an interesting story and one to watch. This is going to be a fascinating one to keep an eye on. Last but not least, Kartik, on the TV streaming news. And that is in this past quarter, the third quarter in the United States, DirecTV has lost 359,000 subscribers. And during that same quarter, DirecTV Now only added 49,000 subscribers in that same time span, which is way, way below what they were doing a year ago. Part of me wonders to a certain extent or to what degree maybe DirecTV and DirecTV Now could be losing subscribers due to losing beIN Sports, losing La Liga, losing Ligue 1. I'm sure that's a percentage of that. How much of a percentage, I do not know. But still, interesting times with DirecTV losing subscribers and DirecTV Now seemingly plateauing.
Now, TV... Yeah.
Go ahead.
Real quickly, I know of one or two people who canceled DirecTV or Comcast. Not one or two, more than that, just because beIN's not offered anymore. Because they had the channel for La Liga. They know they can get NBC and get the Premier League matches via Fubo, so they just switched to Fubo or Sling and cut the cord. And it is specifically because of beIN. So while, again, we don't have a large sample size and we just talk to soccer fans, there is some of that going on, for sure.
Yeah, I do want to mention one more thing, and that is when I was watching the Athletic Real Sociedad game, I think it was on Saturday, it was fascinating to watch it because during the broadcast, Phil Shane, probably about 20 times during that entire 90-minute game, said read from a script and said, hey, if you're a DirecTV subscriber or a Comcast subscriber and you're watching this game over at your friend's house, now's the time to switch. Go ahead and sign up for Fubo or Dish or Sling TV to be able to make sure that you can watch El Clasico and all of La Liga. So the likelihood, and we've said this in the past before, but the likelihood of Comcast and beIN Sports reaching a deal is practically zero. The likelihood now of DirecTV reaching a deal with beIN Sports looks unlikely, especially with beIN Sports making such an aggressive push for people to switch to Dish. So it's not good if you're a DirecTV subscriber, which is a shame too, because DirecTV, historically speaking, Kartik, you know this better than anyone, has always had the best soccer coverage, has always had the most soccer coverage, and here we go losing beIN Sports or dropping beIN Sports. It's a big black hole that they're missing.
Once upon a time, before Bleacher Report Live existed, before Fox began really utilizing their Champions League and Europa League rights, DirecTV had exclusive matches that they would give for free. Well, or, you know, not free, but if you had the right package, they would stream on additional channels for Europa League and Champions League. I got every match for several years because I had DirecTV. They were that committed to soccer 10 years ago or so, 8 to 10 years ago. But now it's a different era. They're owned by AT&T now, which they weren't at the time, and they're making some different decisions.
All right, so let's move on to TV ratings. So we talked about in the news segment about how Major League Soccer numbers for the regular season were up 6% across the entire board, and most of that was pumped up by Fox World Cup matches, Major League Soccer matches after the World Cup. Well, here's an example of something that's a good example of FS1 and really disappointing MLS numbers, and that is the Decision Day broadcast. The only game out of all of them that was on television was Sporting KC against LAFC. This was on FS1, and the viewing number for that game was so low that it didn't even register in the top 150 games programs on Sunday on television. So we have no idea what that number is. If we had a guess, it's probably less than 100,000 people that watched that game. So that's really disappointing.
And unfortunately for MLS, they've done Decision Day for competitive purposes and then tried to brand it. They're doing what other football leagues in the world do, which is simultaneous kickoffs, which I like. But it's unfortunately making programming decisions difficult, because what's happening is that, do you show the best teams? Do you show Atlanta or the Red Bulls? Or do you show the game that's going to impact who makes the playoffs, which then would be involving some very mediocre team, because 12 teams make the playoffs. They may, this time they went for kind of a strange solution, which was Sporting and LAFC, two teams fighting for top seed in the Western Conference, if that's what you would look at, or seeding in the Western Conference, and it just didn't pay off. So The programming decision becomes tough because it can only show one game in that window, while there were, 12 simultaneous kickoffs, or 11 simultaneous kickoffs, and they maybe they picked the wrong game, or maybe they just, there's not much left to play for. I mean, there was very little on the line on Decision Day, right? I mean, I guess the ultimate question was whether the Red Bulls or Atlanta won the Supporters' Shield, and whether LA Galaxy or Real Salt Lake made the playoffs, and that was it. There wasn't much else.
Yeah. I think this is one of those examples where, like, a whip around show would have been good. It's more expensive to actually do to pull off, but that would have been something where they could have gone to the LA Galaxy match and see kind of just all the fans, the players on the floor, in disbelief that they didn't make it through, or go into some of these other games where, you mean the Atlanta game, for example, and just how they fell apart and back and forth. I think that probably would have had a greater viewing number.
Yeah, there was a lot of drama. There was definitely drama, but it just didn't show.
Exactly. Some of the other numbers, so El Clasico, we don't have the Spanish language number yet for beIN Sports and Espanol. But we do have the English language viewing number, and that one was 181,000 people tuned in on Sunday from 11:15 a.m. to 1:15 Eastern time. Usually, beIN Sports en Español is usually about 2 to 3 times bigger number than the English language side. So we're roughly speaking, probably, if I had to guesstimate based on experience, is probably about 450,000 viewers, so maybe 450, 475 for the game, which is far, far below previous years where we've had 1.5 million, I think it was 1 year, and 1 million another year. This is way, way down for La Liga. Some of the other numbers that came through, there's a whole ton of numbers, so we won't go into detail about every single one of them. We will have the full list at worldsoccertalk.com. Some of the Champions League numbers, the Barcelona-Inter game from a couple of weeks ago on TNT had 216,000 viewers. PSV against Spurs, 138,000 viewers. AEK Athens against Bayern Munich on TNT, 138,000 viewers also. So some low numbers there. Milan against Sampdoria on ESPN on Sunday. This is from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern, 122,000 viewers. So for Serie A, the numbers are much greater than they were last year on beIN Sports, but they're not going through the roof. And the Champions League numbers are, I don't know, to me, pretty flat. But we'll have to wait and see what the next numbers are like. All right, so let's move on to Lister Mailbag. First up is Alexander. And Alexander says, I also noticed an improvement for the TNT coverage. One thing that could improve the coverage would be to exclusively have Stu Holden and Steve Nash for the halftime show. The main studio could join in for pre- and post-game. With only two commentators for discussion, they would have more time for in-depth discussion as well as for the many commercials. I do wish TNT would show more, show some of the Europa League games. Some of them are quite entertaining. In a future podcast, can you guys make comments about the new DAZN streaming service and your thoughts on it? What are your thoughts on the Asian leagues? I also noticed that ESPN Plus added the Indian Super League. Personally, I hope that AFC players develop more to make the World Cup more interesting. Europe and South America have a monopoly on World Cup wins, and it would be nice to see other regions become more dominant. So a lot to cover there. Kartik, any thoughts on any of Alexander's comments?
I think it'll be interesting to see if there's more interest developing in Asian football or in Asian leagues in the United States. Historically, there haven't been. One World Sports for a while had multiple Asian leagues. It didn't really work out for them. Same thing in terms of the A-League, on and off the Fox channels for a number of years. The A-League in Australia hasn't really panned out. Now, DAZN, he's giving a superior product and spending a lot of money. So let's see what happens there with that. In terms of the suggestion for TNT, I kind of like it because I think in general, Holden and Nash through the 3 weeks now of Champions League or 3 weeks of group stage Champions League have been more solid than the Atlanta studio. But we saw some improvements from the Atlanta studio this past week. And with Tim Howard there, it's totally different. So, I kind of like that suggestion, but let's see what they do in match days 4, 5, and 6.
So Country Before Party says, regarding last week's MLS ratings on ESPN and FS1, all Eastern Conference games were at 3 and Western Conference games at 5. I would have watched Atlanta against Chicago, but I was watching DC United book their playoff ticket. Not an excuse, just a factor. JP says ESPN's coverage of Major League Soccer has been nothing short of disastrous. Univision has been Major League Soccer's only true network partner over the last 3 seasons. Time to consider other options once the contract is done. Anthony Bello says, hi guys, I would like to bring up a few things in the pod. First, on Kartik's comments on MLS TV ratings, why does anybody have to be a soccer fan or a football fan? Why can't I be a fan of both sports? We have a lot of sports in this country. They conflict, and you don't know how many games I have missed because games in other sports were at the same time. So why doesn't Major League Soccer just match the European calendar? It would be better for the league on the pitch and with the TV numbers. Not much is going on in April. Major League Soccer playoff games would get a lot more viewers going up against earlier season baseball games and early round NBA and NHL playoff games than NFL games. I also want to disagree with Reed Hastings. I don't believe New Fox and Netflix are going to be the winners in the future of the TV. The winners are going to be the companies that combine live programming with on-demand content. Keep your eye on the new Disney streaming service. If they combine all of their on-demand movies and TV shows with ESPN, that could be a winning combination. Also, Amazon could be a player. They seem like they have started to go after live programming to go with all the shows they have. I believe the consumer will be willing would be more willing to buy live and on-demand programming in one package. Thanks. And a lot to cover there, Kartik. For me personally, I have no issue with somebody being a fan of soccer and being a fan of another sport. I think the discussion is last week is about MLS TV ratings, and when those games are scheduled at the same time as NFL games, for a lot of families, it's a tough decision because historically speaking, they might have been brought up as a Packers fan, and their whole family is NFL fans, and now there's a Major League Soccer game on at the same time, and all the family are saying, "Okay, hey, let's put the Packers game on," and somebody's saying, "Like, hey, I want to watch the Chicago Fire game." It's not going to sit well, but to me, a lot of it goes back to calendar. A lot of it goes back to scheduling, and it just doesn't make any sense that Major League Soccer still year after year after year goes through the same cycle, scheduling games right up against NFL games or right at the same time as NFL games. It just makes no sense at all.
Yeah, and actually my comment last week, I was reacting to one particular Philly Union fan who had written to John Tannenwald that he wasn't going to watch the Union because they were playing at the same time as the Eagles. And I thought if you're really committed to MLS and to soccer, you wouldn't sacrifice this one Eagles game. But I see it both ways, right? And I think Anthony's suggestion, first off, going back to the previous comment about ESPN being a bad partner for MLS, I think what happened is the first year of this television deal, they tried very hard to have a permanent window on a Sunday. And as it got later in the season, that did not work from a ratings perspective. So now they are trying to squeeze it among other programming that gets better ratings and has more viewership and more interest. So it was a conscious decision by ESPN that they had to abandon the permanent window because it just wasn't performing at the level the package that it should. Now, back to Anthony's point, shifting the calendar, I'm a strong proponent of this. I think it's along with promotion, relegation, and solidarity payments / training compensation, the most important thing we can do to reform the sport of this country, maybe the most important thing, more important than those other two factors I mentioned. It's not just about television. It's about competitiveness. It's about lining up transfer windows. It is also about player development. Our players in the United States are not developing as quickly as we want them to because they're playing in the hottest months of the year once they turn professional or even when in their semi-pro amateur seasons. They're playing through the hottest months. It is much easier to play and train when it is not as hot, when there aren't heat warnings, when there isn't these sorts of issues that create trainings to be canceled. That happens all the time with these leagues in the summer. Don't kid yourself. A lot of fans don't know that a lot of times teams aren't able to train because there are thunderstorms or it's too darn hot. They're training at odd hours, and that affects player development. They're not getting the repetitions. And I would say, I know cold weather is an issue. You can build around that with the winter break and work around it with scheduling. And heat-related deaths are far higher in this country, in the United States, every year than deaths related to cold weather. Just that, again, people don't seem to want to know that. There are statistics. There's empirical data about that. But people who are against even having this discussion don't want to talk about that. So, Anthony, yeah, I'm in agreement. I think the single biggest thing we can do is shift the calendar. But people don't want to talk about that at the highest levels for whatever reason, even though I think it's a very practical solution to a lot of our problems.
Yeah, and Major League Soccer still seems to be very focused on their priorities. The priorities are expansion teams and sponsorships, and everything else seems to kind of fall by the wayside. They really haven't made any really big changes in recent years, and this is one that should be top of the list. This should be something that they've already addressed and figured out and have a plan for. It doesn't seem that that's happening. Last question is from Nuke. And Nuke says, does Sancho's rise at Borussia Dortmund mean that Pulisic... read this one again. Does Sancho's rise mean that Pulisic's move in the summer might be on or off? Who do you think is likely to go after Pulisic?
I think Sancho's rise, him being an English player, now a full English international, having gotten the senior cap in the last international break and having come through Manchester City's academy, means he's more likely to move to the Premier League, whether it's back to City or it's the Man United or Liverpool or somebody. As far as Pulisic is concerned, I like the look that I've seen from Dortmund when Pulisic and Sancho play together. And bringing in Axel Witsel in the summer has really solidified their midfield and giving really more running room and space for both those young players. And then up front, obviously, we've talked about Alcázar and what he's done since coming in from La Liga over the summer. But I think it probably means Sancho is more likely to move and Pulisic is more likely to stay at this point. Speaking at the beginning of November, maybe I'll have a different opinion in March, but I actually think it may solidify Pulisic with Dortmund for a few more years, which is probably a good thing for his development. I've been very nervous from a U.S. perspective about him going into the Premier League and perhaps have Kagawa, Shaheen, and others when they've left Dortmund maybe at the wrong time in their career. So we'll see. But I think Sancho's rise means Sancho is more likely to move because he is English and it's easier to get him into the league, particularly after Brexit when they're going to have to sign presumably more English players and less EU players.
Speaking of the Bundesliga and Dortmund, the biggest game of the season in the Bundesliga is coming up on November 10th, which is the Dortmund against Bayern Munich game. Unfortunately, it's same old, same old. It's Fox's schedule and college football getting in the way. So this game, the biggest game, Dortmund against Bayern Munich, is going to be on FS2. Now, over the next couple of weeks, I think Friday's game in the Bundesliga is going to be on Fox Soccer Plus. And for the next couple of weeks, most of the games are going to be on FS2 and very few on FS1. And here's an example, again, of a massive match for the Bundesliga on FS2. Why they can't switch it to FX or FXX like they've done in the past, I do not know. It just doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, they're in the process of selling those channels to Disney, as we know. But this is really not a very acceptable situation. I actually already went on my program guide to try and DVR the Friday Bundesliga match this week. And as you mentioned, Chris, it's not on FS1 or FS2, yep. Which was very, very, very disappointing to find. And I've watched more and more of that Friday Bundesliga game of Freiburg this past week. I think that that's a real missed opportunity for Fox because that is the one programming slot they have for the Bundesliga where it doesn't go up against the Premier League. Yep. You're going up against the championship, you're going up against Liga, or sometimes you're going up against La Liga. It's
the game. It's the game that probably has the best chance of being like a gateway drug to pull you in, to get viewers in. You mean if Friday, if people are getting off work early, or you mean from school, maybe don't have any classes that day, to hook them in on that game and get them watching the Bundesliga more and more during the weekend. And it's just definitely a missed opportunity there. So listeners, you can always reach us through email at web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as on facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post comments on worldsoccertalk.com. We'd love to get your feedback. We'd love to read it out on air, whether it's your rants, raves, questions, asking for advice, or disagreeing with anything we've said. We'd love to get your feedback there. So in closing, thanks for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audioboom, and worldsoccertalk.com. And if you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. And Kartik, heading into another busy weekend of club soccer from around the world, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.